From the George Ignatieff Theatre at the University of Toronto, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation presents the 1989 Massey Lectures by Ursula Franklin. Her talks are being broadcast each night this week on Ideas and are called The Real World of Technology. Dr. Franklin is an experimental physicist, professor emeritus of metallurgy at the University of Toronto, and the only woman there ever to have held the title University Professor. She's a former board member of the National Research Council and the Science Council of Canada. She's a fellow of the Royal Society and an officer of the Order of Canada. In these Massey lectures, Dr. Franklin is discussing technology not as gadgets, but rather as a whole set of social and cultural arrangements, characterized by production-based rules for social control, by pervasive mechanization, by mass production with rigid divisions of labor, and by an associated political mindset, all bundled together into a single social system. Her focus is on what it means to live in this real world of technology. Ursula Franklin.
Good evening, and thank you again for coming. The title, The Real World of Technology, was taken to resonate with C.B. McPherson's 1965 Massey Lectures on the real world of democracy. The reason was not only that my own thinking had been much influenced by McPherson, but also that I wanted to look at technology not as wheels and gears and things that go bump in the night, but I wanted to see technology, like democracy, in terms of people, how they live together, the structures that are built. Technology is dreams as well as knowledge. It's method as well as product. And so I have distinguished between holistic and prescriptive technologies because I felt it is really very important to understand that prescriptive technologies that are quite old in and of themselves and prior to any machines are ways in which human work is fragmented and in which the task that one person used to carry out is carried out in subtasks by a number of people. And I had tried to explain in the first lecture that putting people into a very prescriptive mode in which they have no latitude for judgment and decision-making begins to be an acculturation to external control, external authority, to obeying, and to what I said was a seedbed for a culture of conformity. I had talked quite a bit last time about the infrastructures, the sort of things that the public purse had to put into place, things like railways, communication, distribution, particularly distribution of electricity, so that in fact the technologies could develop and be used. And I tried to point out to what extent, after the Industrial Revolution, a link between government and technology was established that was close, that was intimate, and that brought about a feeling that it was naturally an obligation of government, that is, the public purse and our taxes, to be used and spent for the advancement of technology through particular infrastructures. And I want to begin on that building block to say that these public planning and public resource allocations that provided the infrastructures have gone to a point that this is considered normal and natural, and very few people question it. It has become a part of the culture of the real world of technology. And these infrastructures indeed have gone well beyond rail and road, airport and power grids. They include financial and tax structures, information networks, government-sponsored research and development on behalf of the spread of technology. And all these infrastructures could have been designed differently had the first design priority been human development rather than technological development. And I want to at that point stress that many, if not most, technological systems are essentially anti-people. People are seen as sources of problems, and technology is seen as sources of solutions. So when in the factory the owners feel the workers are too slow or too unreliable or too demanding, they can be replaced by machines. When students may not be competent in math, it is computers that the school purchases rather than extra teachers' time and extra human help. And when security agencies in this country feel that Canadian citizens harbor thoughts and might contemplate actions that the state doesn't like, they don't come to these citizens to discuss their grievances or alternate thoughts openly and on a basis of equality, but rather telephones are tapped or files are assembled by purely technological means. And I say that with some feeling because I've been the receiving end of some of that. And the notion that maybe technology constitute a source of problems and grievances, and people might be looked upon as a source of solutions, has very rarely entered public policy and even public consciousness. Now, among all the infrastructures that support particular technologies and their industry, the infrastructures that support the preparations for war and violence are particularly powerful and particularly deeply entrenched. And you note that I do not use the word defense. This is quite deliberate, because if defense, in the sense of maintaining territory and authority, had been the main priority of a country, then other structures with other contents would have been developed in Canada and in the rest of the world, at least during the past 40 years. And there was no shortage of suggestions for these alternate structures of defense, be they based on civilian defense or what one calls defensive defense, which involve a very different mix of military equipment and quite different international channels of communication. This, we know, has not happened. But in terms of infrastructures, the military procurement path works in a particularly simple and straightforward way. The state develops and articulates the need. The state provides the resources for development and production. The state guarantees the final payment and profit. And in the meantime, the state provides financial guarantees in terms of loan or research contracts. All this is carried out today in Canada in a complicated, not to say bizarre, framework of contracts and offsets that exists in order to link that infrastructure into other government needs such as regional development, industrial incentive, patronage, etc. Now, you may say that all is old hat. After all, Galileo was employed in Padua to teach people about military fortification. That's true. That's quite true that there is, has always been a close link between the civilian and the military arm of power. But the modern practices are much broader and have additional dimensions to their activities, and I want to touch on two of those. One is what Anatole Rapoport, the chair of this university's peace studies program, calls a technological imperative. In simple terms, it says, whatever can be done by technical means will be done. And in the military milieu, unconstrained by economic considerations or common sense, one finds a tempting field of opportunity for the practitioners of advanced technology. And they will provide the newest, the most surprising, the most novel application of their expertise, regardless of whether these applications, in fact, address any real situation. That technological imperative can't be quite executed alone because, and this is my second point, once a country has embarked on an arms production system, it falls upon the government to provide the wherewithal for these activities over a long period of time. It can take 10 years between the design and deployment of a weapon system. To keep that technological activity going, public funds have to be expended. To keep the public funds flowing, justifications are needed. And this generates the need for a credible enemy. In the real world of technology that I'm talking about, there are then two tasks for the state. If the government wishes to use arms production as an infrastructure for the advancement of technology, the state has to guarantee the flow of money, and the state has to guarantee a long-time credible enemy. Because without that credible enemy to justify the outlay of public funds, one would not have a situation that would be ongoing over the period of time that technology requires to ripen and bring profit. And this, of course, has a very real effect on people in the peace movement who say, we want to do something else. And your own government steadfastly sits there with a closed door and a closed mind until you realize this isn't that they are noodle-brained. It is they need an enemy in order to keep the technological structure that supports their high-tech development. And so there is that need for a credible enemy, because the enemy has to be credible. The enemy must be cunning, threatening, and just barely beatable by the most ingenious and heroic technologies. Now, it will be very interesting to see what's going to happen now in the current situation with the Soviet Union and the USA. And I would venture that the social and political needs for an enemy are so deeply entrenched in the real world of technology as we know it today, that new enemies will quickly appear. That would assure that the infrastructures can be maintained, and I'm personally very concerned that the war machine will turn inwards, as it already has done in China, and that one has to realize that, after all, the enemy need not be either a foreign government or a foreign national. I want to read you an ad that appeared in the September 11th staff bulletin of the University of Toronto under research notes. And it indicates again to me the process of replacement of enemy and the support for the maintenance of the military-industrial university infrastructure. The ad reads as follows. National Research Council of Canada. The NRC has announced a new Canadian program of science and technology in the support of law enforcement. The proposed Canadian Police Research Institute will involve the NRC, police, corporate and industrial security, universities, government, and manufacturers of equipment used in police and security work, and will research, develop, and evaluate new security-related products. Interested investigators may contact. The real world of technology. On the other hand, there is no reason to believe that the support of any state for the preparation of war and violence is the only possible infrastructure that would promote a national development of advanced technology. Japan, it should be remembered, was prevented by its peace treaty from building up its own armed forces. Japan became, and I would suggest it was because, rather than in spite of these constraints, a major high-tech success. It developed infrastructures that linked government and industry that are somewhat different from the infrastructures that were constructed for the war machine builders. So don't buy the idea that one has to make weapons in order to advance technology. Japan has done superbly well without developing weapons. Before leaving this subject, I want to point out the changes that this development of technology has brought to the role of the citizen in their democratic responsibility and in their response to war preparations and warfare. Just as fewer and fewer unskilled workers are now employed in modern technological production, a country now has little practical use for raw recruits to man a modern technological destruction system. So the abandonment of compulsory military service is not so much a sign of peaceful intentions as it is a sign of galloping automation. But the old pacifist's dream that there might be a war and nobody will come, and consequently the war cannot take place, is no more valid. A war now can take place without anybody coming. And consequently, military service, being there, is no more a prerequisite for war. What is a prerequisite is a citizen's compulsory financial service well before any military exchange begins. And so the resistance motto that used to say, we won't fight, now turns into, we will not pay for the preparations for war and organized violence. And this, of course, is the position of those Canadians who insist on paying their income tax, but redirecting the appropriate portion to a peace tax fund rather than let it be used for the war machine building that I've described. But I think one has to realize, and I hope I can come back to some of the implications in the last lecture, that pacifism in the real world of technology is quite different from what it used to be, just as everything else. I want now to go to a few reflections, general reflections on planning itself. And I'm talking here about planning in the modern sense of prescriptive technologies that I mentioned, planning in the kind that Webster defines very simply as making plans arranging beforehand. And I like that definition of planning because it says very clearly there are planners and there are plannees. There are those who make the plan and those who are subjected to the plan. And that is quite important to realize because just as it is much easier to give good advice than to accept it, it is much more fun to plan than to adjust to plans that others make. Planning is very often carried out in this world of technology without the plannee's knowledge or consent. And in my reading, that sort of planning originated with the prescriptive technology. And as the prescriptive technologies have taken over most of the activities in the real world of technology, planning has become society's major tool for structuring and restructuring. It is through planning that people's are led to perceive what is doable and what is not. The planners themselves are often not fully conscious of the constraints that they put on the plannees, but the effects on the citizens of being planned and controlled are very evident in people's individual reaction to the impingement of technologies of planning on their own lives. And so the real world of technology is full of ingenious individual attempts to sabotage plans. I think if one wishes to carry out plans that are workable, it has to be done either totally by the plannees or with a very long and strong line of consultation. Now, I should say that from what I laid before you in earlier lectures and now, it's probably already quite evident that planning and technological design are usually carried out in order to maximize gain. That the common denomination of planning of technological systems has always been the attempt to adjust parameters for maximum efficiency, for maximum effectiveness, and underlying this is a production model, and it's typically planned to maximize gain. And in such a milieu, it's often quite easy to forget that not everything is plannable. Actually, most things that ought to be described appropriately through a growth rather than a production model, and that means the activities of all living things, are ultimately unplannable. And I give you a quick example from my own experience, because although I was intellectually quite well prepared for the birth of my first child, I was stunned by the degree of randomness that that event created in my life. And it took me a bit to understand that it was pointless to plan in the way I used to plan my days. That didn't mean that I didn't plan or prearrange, but I needed quite different planning strategies to deal with the unplannable. Women in particular have over the centuries, if not millennia, developed strategies of planning of that nature, strategies that are not surrendered to randomness, but an allotment of time and resources that are based on situational judgments, quite akin to what I described in earlier lectures as a characteristic of holistic technologies. These strategies require knowledge, experience, discernment, and a complete oversight of the situation, and they are different in kind from those of the prescriptive planning. What makes them so different is that the context is taken seriously. These strategies are aimed, more often than not, at minimizing disaster rather than maximizing gain. And I don't have to give you a lot of examples. There are some very nice historical ones of redistributive societies among the Incas and the Chinese, where the government would buy grain in good years and distribute grain during poor harvests. But even on a very daily basis, you know that what these are, and we run a international conference of on archaeometry about 2 years ago that was largely run by women. And on the day it opened, three of us had come with a box of aspirin, a box of Band-Aid, and the phone number of our own doctor. And so there are strategies of minimizing disaster. Barrett Oss, who is a well-known Norwegian sociologist and feminist, has very well described in an article on women's culture the difference in these strategies. She sees the modern planning as part of a strategy of maximizing gain, and the techniques of coping as central to all strategies of minimizing disaster. And again, the crucial distinction is the place of context. In strategies of minimizing disaster, one needs a full recognition and understanding of the context, but the context is not considered as stable and invariant. On the contrary, every response induces a counter-response, it changes the situation. So context is a variable that has to be evaluated in the process of both planning and action. Orthodox planning in the prescriptive sense assumes the context is stable and invariant. One doesn't have to bother about it. And so the strategies of planning can, of course, be then transferred from one application to another, since the context doesn't matter. So the maximizing gain strategies all sit on that idea one doesn't have to bother about the context. The minimizing disaster theories and the strategies and the work all sit in the assumption that context is a partner and it is a reciprocal relationship in which each move changes all other moves. Now, you may say it's well to make these academic distinctions between planning strategies, but how would one actually plan to minimize disasters? Not in the family, but in the public sphere. And I want to give you two really quite prominent examples of that, because I'm anxious to show that there are indeed no practical obstacles to planning to minimize disaster. And that can be done in today's real world of technology. And one of the examples is drawn from the inquiry under Thomas Berger into the building of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline. The other is the 1977 study of the Science Council of Canada on Canada as a conservative society. Now, again, the difference is how context is treated. All the features of the report on the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry bear that respect for context. The context had been studied as much as possible, looked upon with all the ramifications of the proposed plan. The considerations were wide. The interaction with the planning milieu was considered important, and the recommendations and the course of action made often mandatory further assessment, built-in revisions, and to the plan's execution. All these features can be seen in the report of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry. The Burger Inquiry itself gathered evidence in many different modes, ranging from listening to native residents in their own communities to questioning experts on the reliability of forecasts of energy needs or gas reserves. It was a very participatory and interactive process, resulting in recommendations of a 10-year moratorium on the pipeline construction, during which land claims and urgently needed protective measures for both the community and the habitat were to be carried out. It recommended, had a number of recommendations, including certain permanent constraints for future technologies. But it showed that one could develop a workable plan to proceed with development while minimizing potential harm. And of course, in addition to the recommendation, the Burger Inquiry generated most valuable documentation, research material that would not otherwise be available, and a public process that will be forever a model on how these things ought to be done. To me, the inquiry proved beyond any doubt that indeed it is possible to engage on a national level in a different kind of planning. And the complexity of the real world of technology offers no fundamental barrier to the implementation of strategies for minimizing disaster. The study by the Science Council on Canada as a conservative society is a slightly different example. Here, the Science Council in 1975, appointed a committee, which I chaired, and asked this committee to explore whether or not Canada could become a conservative society. The notion of a conservative society was defined as follows, and I want to read this to you from the final report. The concept of a conservative society arises from a deep concern for the future, the realization that decisions taken today in such areas as energy and resources may have irreversible and possibly destructive impacts in the medium and long term. The necessity for a conservative society follows from our perception of the world as a finite host to humanity and from our recognition of the increasingly global interdependence. And again, there was the expressed need to minimize disaster. That was on top of the planning agenda. And during the study, background papers, newsletters, and other activities such as workshops were held so that there was a great deal of openness and reciprocity in the process. The assessment, the specific recommendations that we brought forward showed that it's really not difficult to minimize disasters within Canada's existing economic system and political infrastructures. We showed that there was an urgent need to institute public policies and encourage appropriate technological innovation to implement such disaster minimizing strategies. The policy recommendations were not taken by the government of Canada in 1977, and the subsequent onslaught of the gain-maximizing strategies of the 80s have greatly increased the likelihood of environmental and social disasters and have made the restorative tasks much more difficult than they were 10 or 15 years ago. In the meantime, we should remember that the real world of technology is an environment that puts people into conditions and structures that were not designed for their well-being. The environment in which we live is much more structured for the well-being of technology. It is a manufactured and artificially constructed environment, not what one might call a natural environment. While our surroundings may be a milieu conducive to production, they are much less a milieu conducive to growth. I have felt over a number of years now that I'm more and more reluctant to use the term environment, because it seems to me that it has become more often than not a term of befuddlement rather than a concept that's helpful in the search for clarity. And one can ask oneself, what do people mean when they talk about the environment? Is it that constructed, manufactured, built environment that the day-to-day setting of today's world? Or is it what we euphemistically sometimes call our natural environment? Why don't we speak about nature? It seems such an egocentric and technocentric view to consider everything in the world with respect to us. Environment essentially means what is around us, stress on us. It's our environment, not the habitat of fish or bird or flower. The reluctance I feel to use the word nature in political discussions may very well come from the reluctance to acknowledge that there are independent partners on this planet. People are but one part of nature. This recognition is quite different from speaking about our natural environment, which somehow puts nature into the role of an infrastructure, into the role of something that's there to accommodate us, to facilitate or be part of our lives, subject to our planning. And such a mindset makes nature into a construct rather than sees nature as a force and as an entity with its own dynamics. There are some often very small ways in which the real world of technology denies the existence of nature. There's very little sense of season when you walk through a North American supermarket. As a child in Berlin, I still had these little festivities, the joys of the first asparagus, the first strawberries, at the family table celebrating the rare and special gift of an orange in the wintertime. That doesn't exist anymore. And not only is there a little sense of season, there's also a little sense of climate. Everything possible is done to equalize the ambience, to construct an environment that's warm in the winter and cool in the summer, to equilibrate temperatures and humidity, to create an artificial environment that does not reflect nature. The technological capabilities Now allow us to design nature out of most of our lives. This, however, may be quite stupid, because people are part of nature, whether they like it or not. Machines and instruments will thrive and work well in even temperature and constant humidity. People indeed may not. For the sake of our own mental and physical health, we may need the rhythm of seasons and the experience of different climates that links us to other living things. Much has been said, of course, today and is being said about environmental concerns, quote unquote. And in no way I wish to deny the urgent task of cleaning up the environment, as it's so often phrased. But I would like to stress here that there is also an urgent task of cleaning up a technocentric and egocentric mindset, to get rid of the notion that nature is just one more infrastructure to be adjusted, that this is a doable task which the world just happened to have overlooked at this point. Sometimes I think that if I were granted one wish, I would wish that the Canadian government would treat nature the way Canadian governments have always treated the United States of America, with utmost respect and as a great power. Whenever suggestions for action are placed before governments of Canada, their first consideration is, what about the Americans? They may not like it. They may let their displeasure be seen and felt. They may retaliate. And what about nature? Obviously, nature doesn't take kindly to what we are doing in this real world of technology. Nature is indeed retaliating, and we better understand why this is happening. So I would suggest that one should consider nature as a strong and independent power, so that we can ask, what will nature do, before we ask, what will the Americans do? Having spoken about planning, I don't want to close this lecture without touching briefly on the outcome of these plans. After all, plans are made to achieve something. And it is therefore of some interest to see what happened. And the retrospect evaluation of plans and of predictions is not a particularly comfortable undertaking. And it may be for that reason that not much of research into predictions or outcomes has been developed as a discipline. One would think that one could learn a great deal from the study why well-laid plans and well-considered predictions were so totally out of whack. Of course, the literature is full of anecdotes about how great people so misjudged the development of technology and science that they thought manned flight was impossible and that sound could never be carried by a wire and so on. And I'm not interested simply in pointing out how far off others have been, if only in self-defense, because I'm sure much of what I say will not stand the test of time. What I am interested in are reasonably short-range predictions that didn't come true. And they often didn't come true because of a total misunderstanding and misjudgment of context. And this serves to me as a reminder that any possible approach of forecasting the impact of technology, which we have to do, and the future of technology, must involve the experience and the views of the planees, of those who have to live with the technology, rather than only those who design them. I want to stress the magnitude of the human contribution, both for good or for ill, in the real world of technology. When I mentioned earlier the need to look at technology in context, I wanted to stress that that context is nature and people, and where so many predictions turn wrong is when the context is considered as a passive medium and not as a dynamic counterpart. Electrical engineers often speak about inductive coupling. And inductive coupling means that a changing field produces a current which may introduce a countercurrent that may counteract the initial force that produced something. Change produces change, and often in different dimensions and magnitudes. And I think one of the things that I see, whether it is the infrastructures for war, whether it is the look at nature as if it were a manageable non-external force, is that enormous discounting of the capability, the potential, and the power of human beings. And how people respond individually and collectively, as well as the response of nature, is so underrated that all our planning, however sophisticated, suffers from that. Now, it is my firm opinion that it is the planning strategies for minimizing disaster that will give us the techniques, the skills, the instruments to bring those elements that are human and that are universal into processes that are designed to mediate technology. I've kept you longer than I should, and I thank you for your attention.
From the University of Toronto, we're listening to Dr. Ursula Franklin with the Massey Lectures on the Real World of Technology. Each of Dr. Franklin's talks was followed by questions from the audience.
I'm wondering if you could maybe make comment on the idea that if a society has developed a planning process that meets its needs, as the needs change, is it not the nature of a social organization that the planning process will change to meet the changes in the context in which it finds itself?
My answer to that would be a question, whose needs, not what needs. The planning structure always fits well into the needs of the powerful. It rarely ever fits into the needs of the powerless, and that's where the struggle sits. Of course, if you were somewhere on the battlefields in Runnymede, your planning needs would change after the king signed certain documents. If you were a British farmer, your planning needs would be quite unaffected, except if you were elected to Parliament and they probably didn't build a post office, they built a church. But beyond that, it is not so much what planning needs, but whose planning needs. And in what I tried to develop in terms of infrastructure, I pointed out that the main planning needs that are met are the needs for technological development and expansion. And they adjust themselves. What's free trade about? Who planned that one? You had a question.
Thank you. Brian Wilson. I'd like to go back to the question of planning, particularly disaster planning. In the latest, or the September issue of Scientific American, which was devoted to environmental science and where planet Earth is going, there was an article in which it suggested that because of the enormous complexity of the environment, which I would take in this situation to include also the social human environment, because of that huge complexity, the concepts of conventional planning as such may be inappropriate insofar as conventional planning tends to be context-related. One says, let us plan for there being a disaster in such and such an area. And because of the huge complexity, that really becomes a meaningless predictive exercise. And the suggestion is that rather one should try to set up structures relating to disaster management which are much more at a systems level, at almost a meta-planning level, where the main characteristic is not attempting to predict solutions to possible disasters, but rather to set up systems which have tremendous flexibility of response to disasters as they develop. Could you comment on that?
I have an inherent suspicion that all these meta-plannings always seem to produce a meta-mess. I think the approach is the other way around, and I don't know whether you are familiar with the work by Henry Regeer, who's now the director of the Institute for Environmental Studies here at this university, and his work on the Great Lakes. He has taken the Selye concept of stress and said, I will never find out all the things that are wrong with the Great Lakes, but what I know is that that basin is sick. And just like Selye says, in terms of medical illness, one needs a system under stress, and one removes as many stresses as one can, not necessarily looking for causality, but looking for relief. And I think that it is much more likely on that sort of international effort that one doesn't go into modeling and trying to understand everything, but to say that this planet is sick, and whatever stress can be removed must be removed, starting with the easiest and going to more and more difficult ones. Do all the things that are doable fast and see what happens, rather than spend time on meta strategies. That would be my reaction.
Tonight on Ideas, you've heard the third of the 1989 Massey Lectures by Ursula Franklin. This series, called The Real World of Technology, continues tomorrow. The lectures will be repeated at the end of March on Ideas, and at that time an expanded version will be available as a book, published by the CBC in conjunction with the University of Toronto Press. Tonight's broadcast was produced by Max Allen, with Bernie Lucht, Lauren Tulk, and Gail Brownell. I'm Lister Sinclair.